Welcome back, everybody, to a new episode of What's Wrong With Me, David Harsanyi, and her, Molly Hemingway. Molly, how's it going?
It's going great. It's great to see you.
Same.
How are you
Same.
Feeling?
I'm a little cranky today.
Okay.
Got cold and it's rainy. I had a migraine.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay. I got a lot to say.
Okay. Well, let's get to it.
Let's talk about it. Let's talk about the midterms. I think things have shaken out since we spoke last Wednesday, the day after the election. So we weren't sure about the Senate yet. We weren't sure about the House. A lot of races were out there. But now I think it's fair to say Republicans had a pretty bad night considering the expectations, considering historical trends, first midterm elections and new presidencies, things like that.
Well, even more than that, David, I would say they did horribly relative to what they could have done. We know that there were millions more Republican votes than Democrat, that they flipped the generic ballot like 7 or 8 points. They allocated those votes very poorly through bad strategy, or even just by saying they didn't understand the strategy of their opponents. So they, you know, people can overstate it. They're likely to take the House. That's a big deal. And all that it takes to have a majority is one vote. So it's a majority of one versus 100. There are many differences there, but ultimately what you want in a political party is the majority. So people can overstate the problems or overstate the lack of success, but relative to what they should have accomplished, given the realities on the ground and the realities of the voting populace, I think that's fair.
Well, I would preface what I'm about to say with this. I don't think that there's any one reason for why Republicans didn't do well, or one person, or one, you know, or spending. I think it's a combination of a bunch of stuff, depending on what race we're looking at. I have seen you in public, not in private, and in private, say that you know, you do not buy into the claim that there is a problem with the candidates that Republicans ran. The quality of the candidates was not really at fault for what happened, right? Is that fair to say?
I think that the canard of candidate quality is the stupid. I agree that there's no one answer. And anyone who says there's one answer, I think, is stupid. But I think of all the explanations, this like coping mechanism of claiming candidate quality is some huge issue is just objectively not true. And it's just, I don't know, I find it to be the least convincing of all of the explanations out there.
I think it's a bigger reason than you give it credit for, I guess. I mean, I think that if you look at Georgia, there's a bad candidate, a candidate who not only was the wrong person for this race because of their history, and I don't even want to get into all of that, but because what do they stand for? It's an incoherent message. The only reason he ran was because Donald Trump picked him, in my opinion. And then you have Kemp, who ran way ahead of him. And that is not an accident. So that is a quality candidate issue. Do you not agree?
You're saying that that in this race, there's one reason for these differences. And that reason is candidate quality. And I'm saying I just find that to be lacking in many ways.
I don't think it's one reason, though.
You know, Kemp is an incumbent. I saw this thing where Kemp said he gave his ground game to the Senate Leadership Fund so they could use it for Herschel Walker for his runoff. And I'm like, well, that's awesome. But why did they not have a ground game going into the general? So is it candidate quality, or is it like horrible campaigning, which is also admittedly a function of who the candidate is? But you need to emphasize your strengths and de-emphasize your weaknesses. I mean, Warnock, you could say, is a really bad candidate, kind of a huckster. Ran over his ex-wife, claims to be a man of the cloth, but supports abortion on demand through all 9 months of pregnancy. These are really bad things. But if you run a campaign in such a way as to emphasize the positive, decrease the negative in a year when incumbents do very well, I think there are all sorts of other things going on in addition to candidates. The other thing that just annoys me about it is... No offense to my fellow countrymen, we live in an era of very, unimpressive people. So you can point to any single Republican candidate who lost their race and you could say that they were a bad candidate. You could actually point to anyone who won their race. And if it had been different, you would say, oh, well, that's because they were a poor candidate. You could look at every Democrat who won and say, that's weird because they were a poor candidate. Like in this day and age, when you have Joe Biden in the White House and John Fetterman showing up at the Senate today, you're just not going to convince me that candidate quality means anything at all. Like, I'm sorry. Those people are barely functioning human beings, but it didn't matter because their campaigns were run in such a way as to bank ballots. Yeah, they have other things. They have, you know, they have an appeal in addition to being unappealing. They have a media propaganda press environment that helps them. They have big tech companies that help them, but they had campaigns that understood that they didn't really matter and that banking ballots was what mattered. So I just feel like it's a cope to say candidate quality. I'm sorry, Blake Masters is pretty solid candidate, certainly better than Martha McSally, who the establishment loved and adored so much that they had her run as the Republican candidate to help not one, but two Democrats get into the Senate. And nobody talks about, oh, candidate quality when it's all of these people. Or O'Day, prime establishment candidate. They say they care about candidate quality and they gave O'Day in Colorado. That man got less of the vote than Donald Trump in Colorado. So is it candidate quality or is there a lot more going into all this?
It depends what race you're talking about. Listen, you don't have to convince me that we live in an idiocracy, that the voters pick the dumbest candidates possible. It is so unimpressive across the board. There are very few candidates in the country. I'm like, wow, that guy's really competent or that woman really knows what's going on. I mean, you have Whitmer or you have Katie Hobbs. Was that her name in Arizona? These are not impressive people at all. That's partly voters' fault, right? These are the people they vote for. And I'm sorry, Carrie Lake, for instance, I think was charismatic and probably a decent candidate. But I honestly, when I thought about it later, I don't even know what her policy positions were or what she was, you know, it was all just based on dunking on libs. I just don't think that's enough. And I don't think it's impressive. I know I'm all over the place.
David,
so I'm kind of in a ranty
mood.
I'm
sorry, just in terms of raw political talent, how you can look at what happened in Arizona and not think that maybe candidate quality is not the determination here. I don't even know how to get that through to you. Like you had with Katie Hobbs, a woman who sounded like a really meek 14-year-old girl. It was weird to listen to her. Speaking of no positions, that would be Katie Hobbs. She never debated. She never held campaign events. She never worried for a minute because it wasn't about her. It wasn't about positions. It was about brute force ballot operations. And she got the ballots over the finish line with a massive ballot operation going on against someone who didn't have that, who was running a traditional campaign where you take your message to the voters, you make your case to the voters, and she is going to narrowly eke out a victory, not because she was a good candidate, but because she had, you know, the operation going. And I agree with you, by the way, on the messaging issues. Like I was talking to Laura Ingraham on her radio show earlier today. And I was like, I'm a professional like political watcher. And I'm not sure I could articulate for you what the Republican message was for why you should vote for them. And I mostly meant that in a Senate or House sense, mostly in the Senate sense, a little bit in the House sense, but it even applies for a lot of these gubernatorial races. Like what's the Republican, do you know what the Republican message is? Like the case for voting for them?
No, I do not know. My position would be that they will stop Democrats from doing anything. But the gridlock position, which is basically my entire political philosophy, is not very popular with voters, apparently. It was a very weird election.
You won.
Yeah, I guess the House, but it should have been bigger. It should have been the Senate. It was not a definitive statement against the Biden administration and what's going on. It just wasn't. And I think that's a big problem.
And again, one thing I think, and I'm not a fan of the Democrat Party. I think the changes that they have brought to our election system are deeply damaging to the Republic, but they played the game according to the rules that they manufactured, and they played it well. They had a massive deficit of millions of votes. They had horrible polling, and then just like an objective reality that was very bad. Bad economy, bad border, bad crime, bad everything. And those people focused on 20 to 25 House races and like 5 Senate races, and they turned on their machine operation in those places to, there are many things you can say against the Democrat Party, but running a long con to change our voting rules and then, you know, counting on the stupidity of the Republicans to not match any of that and run your ballot harvesting operations, it's not bad. I mean, they deserve credit for this.
Well, listen, there are states that tightened up election integrity, right? And there are states
like what?
That,
like which one?
Would you say that Georgia did?
So I would, and I want to point out the number one thing that they did so that other people can emulate this. They didn't really do much, and I hate when they get a lot of credit because it wasn't that much. But probably one of the things they did that probably saved the Warnock-Warner race to being a runoff, who knows what will happen in the runoff, but just to make it to a runoff, was demanding ID with absentee ballots. It's a no-brainer that you want an ID associated with a ballot. But that was one of the reforms that they put forward, and it was a key reform.
I just wanted to say, and I think that you said this on Fox News, I saw on Twitter, that at some point you try to make the changes in election integrity laws, you try to pass them in states that you run, but at some point you have to stop whining and start playing their game and beating them at their game. That's the only way you're going to win elections, right?
Yes, I actually think you do both at the same time, meaning I hate the change to election season. I do think it's an attack on democracy to not have debates and to not have persuasion and to not have a campaign. I think ballot harvesting operations are fundamentally bad for the body politic and for our civic health. I hate them. I think it's wrong. And I agree with former Attorney General Barr when he said it's like telling each juror that they can come to a verdict at any point they want, instead of working together through a campaign as a people, coming to a decision, voting on one day, having the answer on one day, and moving on. Like, I so prefer that. But yeah, very few other people agree with me. And regardless of whether they did or not, the rules are what they are. And so what are you going to do? Just complain while the Republic dies? Or are you going to go do a ballot harvesting operation of your own? Like, I don't like it, but I feel like, what else are you going to do? Just let the left destroy the country completely?
No, you win states and then you tighten up election laws if you can. I mean, that's the only way you can do it.
We talk about predatory tech companies all the time here on Federalist Radio Hour, but did you know your internet service provider knows literally everything you do online? It's true, and think about that. You might as well just be handing your laptop to a stranger and opening up your browsing history. That's why having a VPN is an absolute must every time you go online. I want to tell you now about one of the best VPNs out there and easily one of the most affordable ones I've seen, PIA. PIA stands for Private Internet Access, and they take privacy seriously. Not only does PIA hide your IP address, it encrypts your entire connection. This protects your internet activity from everyone, your internet service provider, network admins, or any hackers out there just itching to steal your most sensitive information. PIA is the world's transparent VPN. They never record or store user data, and their no-logs policy has even been verified in court. You also get endless entertainment options. Not only does PIA work with all major streaming services, but it's one of the few VPNs that supports P2P file sharing, so you can download just about anything. You can connect to over 83 countries using their world-class servers, and there's a server for every single U.S. state. You get your own dedicated IP address for 100% anonymity. It's available for all platforms across all your devices, and just one membership can protect up to 10 of your devices at the same time. PIA has over 30 million downloads. See for yourself how it makes browsing so much better. And again, I just love that it encrypts your entire connection. You can connect in every single state with its own server. Amazing. and you can do that on 10 of your devices at the same time. That's a great deal. Right now, go to PIAVPN.com/Federalist to get a whopping 82% off your VPN service, plus 4 free months with a 2-year plan. It comes out to around $2 a month, and you just can't beat that. And there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's PIAVPN.com/Federalist for 82% off private internet access. PIAVPN.com/Federalist.
Part of the fallout here is sort of recriminations, or I wouldn't call it a civil war, but between, you know, the establishment, I guess, and the populist wing, right, of the party. Just say that that's fair, especially in the Senate when it comes to McConnell. Not yeah, McCarthy, I think just won. I think he's going to be House leader, right?
Huh. I didn't see that, but they were voting on it like as we were going into this. So, okay.
Because he's going to have a 1 or 2 seat majority, which is the... What Sean Davis was saying, and I think, you know, I'm giving him credit for this, but it's like the worst job in DC, right? I mean, you have so many weird personalities in the Republican Party right now, and it's going to be very difficult to corral them to do anything, but probably you're going to see some gridlock. So that's good. How do you see the future of the Senate majority leader's seat? Is it going to be McConnell? Is anyone going to challenge him? What's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I assume it will be Mitch McConnell. I haven't even seen anyone make a serious challenge to his power. But that top line issue does not reflect the trouble that he's in. And what I mean by that is Mitch McConnell has been leader for a very long time, nearly 2 decades. He runs a very tight ship in DC. He runs most of DC. He has control over much of the media. He has an army of political consultants that are put out on campaigns. He controls a big pot of money, not just in his Senate leadership fund, but in the direction he provides other donors. He is a very, very powerful person. And I also want to just say, because sometimes people get so into being anti him, he has some things to his credit, including what I've written about with Kerry Severino in Justice on Trial, with his work on federal judges. You know, another kind of like parliamentary legislative fun that he's had. And it really is impressive and good. He also has this huge list of downsides. You know, he went to war against the Tea Party famously and won from 2010 to 2014. That victory, though, probably resulted in Donald Trump winning the nomination in 2016. He handled Donald Trump's presidency mostly through hostility, supporting the Russia collusion hoax, undermining key agenda issues, not working with him to achieve greatness so much as viewing him as an opponent of some kind. And here in 2022, you know, he's failed to take advantage of a majorly fertile area for elections. He failed to deal with the reality of the change in how we do elections. He did nothing to stop the Biden agenda. He actually helped it along in key ways and never provided a vision for what it would be like if Republicans took the Senate. He famously said he thought that the inadequacy of Biden was sufficient for Republicans to capture the Senate. That's obviously not true. He went out of his way to tear down the candidates Republican voters chose in the primaries rather than be their biggest cheerleader. And all of this results in, yes, he will continue to hold power because he controls all the power, but he is weakened. And you see this in how not just constitutional conservatives like Mike Lee or Ted Cruz have been kind of sniping about what he did, but Marco Rubio came out and said he thought it was time to have a debate about Senate leadership, whether they were truly invested in the voters of the party and whether they had a vision for how to lead in the future. And having people like Marco Rubio come out and say that shows that there is growing dissatisfaction with McConnell and that you might see increased challenges to his leadership over the next 2 years. What do you think?
You're in much better touch with what's going on there than I am. I would just say from my perspective, you know, there are I'm a bigger fan of McConnell probably than a lot of Republicans are. You know, I think he's one of the most consequential conservatives, and you gave him credit, you know, in the past 20 years. He's done a lot of great things. We wouldn't have Roe overturned without him, in my opinion. But funding Alaska, sending millions to Alaska, not Arizona, and you know, just the way that he seems to bolster people who will keep him in power rather than the races that need the most funding from him and most support from him, I think is problematic for him moving forward. I mean, he has to take some responsibility and culpability for what happened. And I haven't heard him do that at all, right?
I actually haven't heard anything from him at all, unless you count right. the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, which kind of serves as his mouthpiece. He hasn't been out there at all. He hasn't said anything other than to have his lackeys throughout the DC landscape blame the orange man for his losses. And it's fine. I wanted to blame Orange Man a little bit myself here, but go on before I do that.
I was just going to say, I just don't know who is available right now who would be as proficient in using, you know, a parliamentarian to get things done. Or who could wield that kind of power in DC, who I would trust more than him, who would have the support that he still has, right?
Yeah, I don't know who might be interested in this type of thing. I think the idea from McConnell world was that they would hand over power to one of their people in the Senate, like a John Cornyn or a Thune. Mm-hmm. I think what people who want his vision of the Republican Party gone should be thinking is, who can they support who unites both the establishment donor class and the Republican voter? This is, both sides can be kind of annoying in how they do these purity tests for each other. And this is why I am so much less harsh on Kevin McCarthy, who's certainly not a conservative ideologue at all, but he doesn't seem to be at war with the base of his party. He plays along with the establishment. He plays along with the base. And this seems like a bare minimum to have in a leader. Whereas McConnell goes out of his way to disparage the base. He went out of his way to support Liz Cheney after the Republican Party of Wyoming had ousted her, after she was ousted by the conference on the House side. He would give her verbal support. She thanked him for it as much as a few weeks ago. You know, he doesn't like the Republican Party that he leads. And that's just probably not, I mean, we all hate our fellow man at times. But you want someone who knows that a unified GOP is a strong GOP. And he, for too long, has gone to war, and openly so, against the base of the party, instead of showing how to capture that base for political gain. And again, Democrats are a mess frequently. They've been saved by a ballot operation. But even on the issue of leadership, like Nancy Pelosi tells those people running for the House, if you want to tear me down every which way from Sunday, that's cool as long as you win. Mitch McConnell is like, I will support Lisa Murkowski because her opponent criticized me. I will sabotage Blake Masters because he criticized me. Showing objectively that he cares more about being on the top of a smaller pile than bringing Republicans to victory in the Senate. That's, again, not putting the needs of the voters ahead of his own personal needs or empire needs.
I have a very hard time with these conversations because I kind of don't, I'm very interested in what you're saying, but I kind of hate the Republican Party and don't care that much. I hate the Rockefeller wing. I hate the Buchanan wing, which is basically what we have now. And I just wish there was some coherent message from the Republican Party that was more idealistic, that spoke to people who are gettable voters. And we, you know, Republicans lost independence this time. They should have gained far more, and they just don't have it. And the infighting is annoying.
Okay, yeah. Two things. One, I would say it's okay that you hate the Republican Party. They're worthy of hate. And it's okay that you hate these various wings. I don't hate all the wings that you mentioned, but it's better to just look at it as, this is the vehicle through which most of what I seek could potentially be accomplished. Not, this is a perfect vehicle.
Of course, I understand that. Okay. I would call myself a libertarian realist, where I want the party to be more like me, but I realize that we're not going to live in a minarchist fantasy of my dreams, right? But this is the thing I don't think either faction understands. they are both unwilling to support the other faction. I have not seen more. There is more hatred from the populist wing of the party towards the establishment in their own party than there is for the opposition sometimes. And that's not healthy either. You know what I'm saying? I just feel like that is why, McConnell will say the things he does and so on.
I want to get to this issue of independence that you mentioned. And yeah. I have to get back to that, but I want to just, oh, darn it. Sorry. Someone just called while you were saying, and there was something you were just talking about. What was it?
How they lost independence or should have gotten more of
them. No, but what was the thing before that? Oh, I don't know. Sorry. Yes. You're saying these people hate the establishment too much. And I do agree with that. But what we have right now is this situation where both the establishment donor class through McConnell and the voters have shown that they are willing to sink the Republican Party rather than let the other one defeat them. It's like a mutually assured destruction pact. But there is a way through this, which is there are the both sides could kind of give a little bit and get something good. They could, the donor class could stop shoving crap candidates down people's throats and just give better candidates that respond to the actual desires of the people while still being amenable to the donor class. They could put themselves out a little bit sometimes when the voters pick someone that they don't want. And the voters could understand that having the biggest flamethrower is not always the best idea. Both sides could kind of give a little, work together and be unified, focus on what went well. I mean, that there's this aspect of the victory of the election outcomes this time that they should be very happy about, which is for a long time, they were this sort of white elite party that's gone. They're a much more multiracial working class group of voters. This is good. That was true in this election. There's a lot that can be built on. So it's not all bad.
Yeah. But I mean, I think you downplay what happened a little bit in the sense. Oh, didn't Blake Masters, for instance, say that he would vote against McConnell if he went to the Senate
before? Yeah, that's why I mentioned.
And, yeah. I'm just saying that, you know, I don't know why he's expected to simply support candidates who literally say they're going to strip him of power.
David, yeah. I just gave the example of how Nancy Pelosi has told her members who are or her candidates who are running, you can call me the Wicked Witch of the West. I don't care as long as you get a Democrat victory in this seat. McConnell should say, in fact, he'd probably get even more support if he did this. Do whatever you want to run against me so long as you win a Republican seat. Because like once we get to a Republican majority, I can battle it out and maybe keep on being leader. But instead, he goes out of his way to sabotage. And it's not just his money, but when he doesn't give money, other people don't give money. You know, like there was this last minute push in New York for Lee Zeldin. And it was important, not just for some of the big money, like the big official money, but it signaled to other donors and other activists, like get to New York. And it ended up saving the House because they flipped like five seats. It showed leadership. You want to show leadership and not pettiness. Too much pettiness.
I don't know. I want a civil war in the Republican Party. I'm sick of the whole populist economic view. I'm sick of the idea that just because voters that politicians are supposed to lead, convince, come up with a messaging that appeals to voters. Voters change their minds all the time. They are fickle. You can convince them. But yet now we're, you know, it's like that saying during the French Revolution where the guy hears the mob marching and he's like, I got to run out there. The people are marching. I must lead them. You know, it's like the opposite of what should be happening in politics. This idea that you just said it. I mean, you're just saying that that they should be amenable to any kind of candidates the people pick, basically. And that just because they're picked I should tell the audience that she's making faces is why I'm getting all worked up. These primaries, a very small number of people pick these candidates for the whole state, right? That is a big problem because the biggest flamethrowers, as you say, are always going to be more active in party politics and state party politics, and they're picking terrible candidates. And I'm not, forget about the quality of the candidate issue. I'm just talking about as people who are feasible, coherent candidates. the right candidates to run in the states. Dr. Oz is the wrong candidate, obviously, because they lost. I wanted to say this before. Yeah, thanks for reminding me. All these candidates that you mentioned who basically can't cobble together a sentence, one, they won, so they're a better quality candidate than the other candidate is. Dr. Oz lost to someone who had brain damage. That means he's a terrible candidate.
There was this Babylon Bee thing. It was like, do you want the party who elected a brain damaged man senator or the party that couldn't defeat the brain damaged man for senator? It's like, well, it's kind of hard to know. But you had said so many wrong things and I don't have time to go through all of them.
One quick thing. I just want to add to another wrong thing. Here's my problem with the populist economic, the populism stuff, that I think that people are misconstrued Trump's victory as a big realignment of the country. I don't think that actually happened. And because now you're so focused on trying to win that kind of voter, and there's nothing wrong with that, you forget about suburban voters. You forget about college educated voters. They're a growing demographic while working class demographic is shrinking. And I just think for the future of the party, of the Republican Party, it's a bad idea.
Okay,
just wanted to throw one more wrong thing in there for you.
There's so much. I want to go back to what you said about Democrats winning independents. And I think that that is a misunderstanding of the votes that they captured. And it gets back to this fundamental issue of how we've moved from campaigns to ballot harvesting operations. When you have a ballot harvesting operation that goes on for 6 weeks, what you're trying to do is find pockets of low information, low propensity voters who you can get ballots into their hands, help them fill it out, and put it in the ballot box. These type of people might not know there's an election going on. They might not know what the issues are. They might not know who the candidates are. It doesn't matter if you get enough money and manpower on these pockets of low propensity, low information voters, you can put a Katie Hobbs into the governor's office. It's not about persuasion. It's not about anything. Those people that I've just described would frequently be described as independents. They might even think of themselves as independents. That's both bad news and good news for Republicans, in that bad news, Democrats have capitalized on this for the last few years, and they're increasingly refining their operations. The good news is there are like 100 million people who didn't vote in the most recent midterms. There are low propensity, low information voters who could be exploited by the Republican Party as well as they have been exploited by the Democrat Party. There's not some like greater meaning in independents who don't really exist. It's kind of like saying low information people, or just people who aren't being honest about what their party affiliation is another big chunk of that. But you can overinterpret all of these things if you don't understand the fundamental issue is election day is dead. Election season is on. We've got massive ballot moving operations, and they explain a significant chunk of what happened. I'm not saying that other things don't explain as well, but it's a big chunk of the explanation is that.
Okay, I can see that. That's true. But from my perspective and what I do and what I talk about and what I think about, I'm thinking about policy and issues and stuff like that. I think the ground game and how people run campaigns, it's super important. You know a lot about election integrity issues and right. I, you know, and all that. But there's also a philosophical political debate going on. It is and Republicans are basically incoherent right now.
Do you think we could table this issue of like economic populism, policy ideas for like next week, because I really want to talk about it. And I know we don't have time to kind of get into it at the level I'd like to. But I think I want to kind of fight.
I have a long, angry rant coming later this week, so we can base our discussion on that.
I want to fight you. It's weird because my big problem with a lot of the new right stuff is also economic based, but I'm much more friendly to an economic policy that helps the working class than you are, apparently.
No, I think free market stuff helps the working class more than any of that kind of protection.
Me too.
So that's the point. Yeah, I want to help.
And I don't actually think that what we've been calling free market is actually free market. That's where I get annoyed that we say like, oh, these trade agreements that are 600 pages long, that's the free market. If it were really the free market, it would be one page long. You know, it's not free market stuff that gets sold as free market operations.
All right, let's talk about that next week.
Okay.
That's a big topic, obviously, and I think it's going to be part of the debate. Yeah.
I wanted to complain about the orange man really quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
So my thing on him, I get so annoyed at the Mitch McConnell operation to displace blame that he should hold on himself by putting it on Trump. But one thing is, he did help these people get nominated in the primaries, and he should have, more than anyone else, understood that the establishment would therefore try to sabotage some of these people. And it was really incumbent upon Trump to get them across the finish line, given that the Republican Party leadership would be so hostile to these guys. Like, if you're going to play in the primary, you had to start paying attention to whether there would be game playing from the donor class. And so it was really incumbent upon him to get them across the finish line. And it's not that he didn't help. Like, he did help Blake Masters. He did help a lot of these candidates. He did raise a lot of money, even for the Republican Party establishment. He raised like $350 million, which doesn't get mentioned a lot, by running, you know, by helping them with their campaigns. But he should have done more.
I'm sick of him. I mean, I've been sick of him for a long time, but I'll tell you what really is, you know, if you're talking about getting together, about compromising to unify the Republican Party, the way to do that is not to go after literally two of the best candidates, the most successful Republican candidates in the whole governors in the country, a day before and a day after the election. He went after Youngkin and he went after DeSantis.
I don't think that's the problem. It's not that they like won or that it's the day after the election, because the 2024 primary is beginning and he views them as opponents. My problem with it is his success has always been to go after the establishment. And Youngkin's a little bit that way, but he actually ran in a pretty unifying, moderate way in terms of the divisions in the Republican Party. And then DeSantis is like his baby. You know, he helped DeSantis cross the finish line. DeSantis has learned from the master. The idea that you would attack the people who are sort of more friendly to you than the establishment that is clearly trying to take you out shows a failure of strategy there. But I remain open-minded. Like, we'll see how he announces. We'll see what his idea is here. We'll see what happens. And I'm more interested in the next few months right now than I am the 2024 primary, but I guess fate will not allow us to.
Well, I mean, today is, what is today? Tuesday. And today, mm-hmm. Donald Trump is probably going to announce he's running for the presidency, right? So how are you going to table that discussion? we have to talk about it.
My whole strategy for sanity over the last 6 years has been to obviously think about Donald Trump. He was the big guy in the 2015-2016 primary. He was president for 4 years. You have to think about him, but not to make everything rotate around him. And so I remain open-minded, and like, I'm not going to tell people what they should think. Like, I just feel like they're of the things that people should think about. I'd like to kind of see how things shake out before, you know, trying to tell people they have no right to consider him the top, or to consider him as a contender.
I've never tell people what to think. I just tell what I think, and I can't believe anyone cares. But right now I think that it's a mistake actually for him to announce so early. I think he's going to be out there by himself. Even though now that I'm thinking about it, he'll be lifted by the press because they'll think that he's far more beatable than DeSantis, in my opinion.
Yes, the press is notoriously friendly to Donald Trump. That's excellent analysis.
Yeah, I mean, in 2015, they thought he would be easily beatable. They gave him tons of free airtime, billions of dollars worth. I'm not saying they're going to say, oh, Donald Trump's great. I just think they're going to
more funny to me is all these people who hated Ron DeSantis when he was doing good stuff are all like, oh, Ron DeSantis seems like a really good contender. And I agree, he does seem like a great contender, but it's so transparent that these people view him as nothing more than a means to take out Trump. And as soon as he might do that, they would move on to trash.
Oh, I think they want a civil war on the Republican side. And I think once DeSantis, if he would win the nomination, they would just say he was worse than Trump, which they've probably already done in the past. Any event, is there any chance that Donald Trump, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you think there's any chance he's not going to announce that he's running for president tonight?
I don't, first of all, while I understand what he says better than most other journalists, I don't actually understand what he'll do better than anyone else. And so my only thing I've always gone by is he's unpredictable. But given my conversation with him, I guess it was last week, and who I've talked to that are working on building up the campaign operation is like fully getting into place. It has been, it's pretty competent at this point. I also think he has to run in a way. Like, this is why I thought he should have announced in the summer. And if he had, he would not have been raided by the FBI, or I think it would have made it less likely that he would have been raided by the FBI, which remains.
Oh, yeah. What happened to that? What happened to that case? Like, it's out of the news. Like, I haven't even thought about it.
Oh, did you see, by the way, that Rudy Giuliani, a man who, by the way, I was fairly critical of in my book, Rigged, about all the changes to the election process, that there was all sorts of drama about how he was going to be indicted for digging into Ukraine corruption. And then it was, you know, leaked or announced yesterday that, it turns out he's not going to be indicted. I mean,
weaponizing law enforcement and prosecutors weaponizing this sort of thing with their leaks is really very fascist-y, I have to say. And that includes the raid on Donald Trump. If there are going to be no charges filed, then what was that all about? It was clearly an effort in some way to affect the election.
But also, there should never have been a raid. There should never have been charged. Like, it was all so stupid. I'm not saying that there aren't disputes about paperwork when presidents leave office. There literally always are. The idea that you would raid Mar-a-Lago over it, I mean, it's just still so insane. Oh, sorry, David, one more thing I wanted to say about this as it relates to Trump and McConnell and everything. One thing I wish that the establishment that has clearly put all resources into ending Donald Trump this week, one thing I wish they understood is that so long as you have Mitch McConnell in power, you empower Donald Trump. There are a lot of people who understand that in addition to Trump's amazing strengths, he has amazing weaknesses. But insofar as he's like the only one really willing to take on the idiocy and like awfulness of the establishment as personified in Mitch McConnell, he has a lot of power. And I speak as someone who understands this very much. Like, if the establishment truly wanted to get rid of Donald Trump, they should have actually governed really effectively after both while he was president and after he was president. They should have adopted all of his strengths and, you know, left the weaknesses aside, and they should have gotten rid of people like Mitch McConnell. And that would do more than anything else. Not, you know, I know they think like a New York Post cover authored by famous never Trumpist, you know, crazy man John Podhoretz is going to do it. Actually, no, like, dealing with the problem of your establishment and its war with the voter is how you would do it if you really wanted to do it. Can we talk about like what you're watching or what bad ideas?
I have a grievance against you that I wanted to, and it's not political.
By all means, please tell us.
And I apologize, you know, for this episode. I'm all over the place. I'm a little cranky. I'm very annoyed, but you and I, we communicate on many different what would you call them? Platforms, right? Okay. There's many platforms. I would say there's about four or five. And I'm always, I try to reach you, right, on one platform, like, let's say Signal. And then you're like, where are you on my phone? When I send you on my phone, you go on to Gmail and you're like, what's going on? I can never track you down, and you're always on a different mode of communication. So I just wanted to complain about that. That happened today.
I don't have anything to say because you're so right. I am a texter, Gchat, Gmail, Signal phone person. Like, I use them.
I'm like, I'm gonna ask her if she's ready for the podcast on Signal. And then you send me a Gmail and you're like, where are you? I don't see anything. And it's funny because it's constantly going there to get in touch with you. And then you've texted me on my phone.
In my defense, David, yeah. I have a lot going on and a lot of people contacting me.
No.
I'm short a personal assistant right now. I'm working on it.
All right. I understand. You're incredibly busy. You're always, you know, you're jet setting around the country and all of that. I get it. What I've been watching, I have to say this. I don't have patience to start new shows, really. I've tried many times. I'm actually watching a show on HBO that I hadn't ever seen, which got really good reviews. And John Milius is the, I believe, director or the writer. It's called Rome. It's from like the mid-2000s. So I'm really enjoying that. But other than that, I have to say, I went onto the Roku channel and I'm watching old episodes of the Great British Baking Show. That's literally what I watch like 90% of the time. It relaxes me. Yeah. How about you?
First of all, how did you like Rome? Should I start that?
I like it. It's slightly pornographic and a lot of violence.
Oh, I don't do so great with that.
Yeah.
Hold on. Okay, well, I watched two things recently, and really it's one and a half, because I fell asleep halfway through one of them. But I really liked the half that I watched, which was a movie called Red, which I think came out like 15, 20 years
with
ago.
Bruce Willis?
Bruce Willis and that really pretty girl.
Oh, I don't know. Wasn't Helen Mirren in it? And
she's in it and she's pretty, but that's not what I'm talking about.
No, I don't know.
Oh, she's like smart and funny and sexy and pretty. Mary, what is her name? Oh. Hold on. I'm looking it up while we talk.
Yeah, there was
Mary
a sequel
Louise
to
Parker.
That.
Oh. She's really pretty.
Yeah.
And other interesting people are in it. And it's a spy thing, but I don't know if it really. I don't know if it just had great promise and then went off the cliff because, like I said, I fell asleep. So I'm going to try and watch that.
I think it was okay. There was also a sequel. Huh. I mean, the premise is sort of older or almost senior citizen spies who come back to work, right? Basically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What?
By the way, this reminds me. Yeah. I was briefing new members of Congress on Sunday night, and there was this woman who was also briefing them who's a current member of Congress. She's a firecracker, and she was giving great advice, very practical advice. And she's a big conservative, so it was kind of cool that she's not just philosophically there, but practically there. And her name is Kat Kamick. And afterwards, I was talking to Harriet Hageman and Kat Kamick. And Harriet, of course, defeated Liz Cheney brilliantly in the primary. She's from Wyoming, where I lived when I was very young. But Kat says she went and campaigned for Harriet, which worked well for her because she grew up in Colorado. And I was like, well, where did you grow up in Colorado? Because that's, you know, where I lived for a long time. She says Castle Rock, which is where I grew up.
Yeah,
I was like,
I know.
Where'd you go to high school? And she said Douglas County. And then I said, well, what year did you graduate? And she said 2006. And I was like, that's not a real year to graduate from high school. Like, I didn't even know what to say. Like, that she's a child who's sitting in Congress, and this isn't even her first term. And I was very confused because I graduated in 1992. Anyway, it's pretty cool that she was from Castle Rock, along with noted Academy Award nominee Amy Adams and other prestigious people.
Yes, I graduated in 1987.
Old man.
But a year early.
And Representative Hageman was like, I graduated in the 80s. You both are stupid. So anyway.
One time I was in Colorado at an event on the West Slope, and a guy sat next to me who had lived there forever. And asked me where I'm from. I said, New York. And he asked me, well, where in New York? I said, Forest Hills. He's like, get out. Me too. Then we kept going and getting, you know, granular. We kept getting lower. And we grew up like a building apart and were born like a year apart in Forest Hills on Austin Street. So it's like, this is weird.
It's
he had
awesome.
Been driving to UCLA and he met a woman there in, I forget what the towns are out there. Something Springs. What's out there in Colorado on the West Slope? Anyway. And he married
Glenwood
her and stayed
Springs?
There. No.
The Gosa Springs is Southern Colorado.
Yeah. Anyway, he met this woman, stayed there, and just that was it.
Okay. I have another movie.
Okay.
Which was.
Will you admit that this is the weirdest episode that we've ever recorded? Completely off, you know, anarchy.
You were a little mean, but other than that.
I was mean? I wasn't mean. I got a little worked up. Yeah.
About this Paul Newman thing, It was this private detective movie called Harper.
Wow.
William Goldman's screenplay based on a Ross McDonald like character. It was interesting. I liked it.
Never even heard of it. Oh, you know what I rewatched?
What?
Have you ever watched Training Day?
I love Training Day.
I don't think that there has ever been a better performance on film than Denzel Washington in that movie. I mean, it is just mesmerizing.
That's exactly what I think. I'm in love with Denzel. And
Ethan Hawke is also, who I don't think is very charismatic or anything, is just perfect for that role.
Very well written. I should rewatch that. I'm going to rewatch that.
Yeah, it's on Netflix.
David?
I love that movie. Yeah.
Any other updates on the thing that our listeners love more than anything, which is the story of your efforts to be in the real world?
Not really. I have to say I've had a tough week. I've had some migraine headaches, but also I have quails in my house. I don't know if you know this. I think you do. Mm-hmm. And they're in my house. Like right now, I'm looking at them. They're in my office. They live here. And I've been trying to get rid of them because I don't want them in my house anymore. And I finally found some people and I wanted to sort of try to connect with them on the quail front. Like we're both homesteading farmers, that sort of thing. But I know so little about it that felt very flat. So no, I don't.
Okay. Well, sorry. I think you should get back out there. We're all rooting for you.
I'm going to get back in touch with that couple. I decided I'm going to ask them to go play miniature golf. Is that a good idea?
I love miniature golf.
We talked about this. Yeah, the miniature golf once. Yeah.
I like it.
My life is so boring. I have nothing to say. You ask me that. I'm like, no. Here's the true answer. No, I've been in my room the whole time. The whole week.
David, I was just talking with one of my best friends who separated from her husband, and it was high drama, and there's like a lot going on. And then she was like, so what's going on with you? And I'm like, nothing. And I couldn't be happier about it. You know, like I have a wonderful husband, great kids. We have a very chill life, and I thank God for it every day.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. I know you do. Yeah, I have nothing going on really, so I'm going to have to think about some shtick for next time to talk about.
Okay, well, so we'll continue fighting on all this stuff later.
Absolutely. I wanted to quickly just say, if anyone has any comments about this show, if they want to complain about this episode, or they have questions, or they have any advice for us, or any recommendations for us, they should email us at radio@thefederalist.com.
I do want to say really quickly on that point, mm-hmm. we get reader email at The Federalist all the time, like tons of reader engagement. We also have comments at The Federalist, and it's all pretty good. The comments we have gotten mostly in response to things you're saying, David, whether it's about your personal life or your wrong opinions about candidate quality, have been amazing. I should have just read the amazing letter that someone wrote critiquing you about your candidate mm-hmm. qualities. I kind of want to publish it even. Maybe I should talk to the guy who sent it. I don't know. I just feel like whoever's...
I don't know. I think he had a complaint about you as well in that letter, if I remember correctly. Yeah, he did. You used a naughty word on the show, and he was not happy about that.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
We don't need to publish that part.
So we could skip that part, edit it out. I didn't read the whole letter because I was bored, because I know I'm right. Do we have anything else?
Yeah, I apologize for saying the bad word.
It wasn't really bad. It was. Sucks.
And my mom gets mad. That's not a bad word.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we should be able to curse and then beep it out.
Yeah, let's work on that.
I use words all the time that our editors take out that I think are perfectly fine words. Do you want to hear some of them?
No, I don't want to offend this like brilliant writer. Joe was his name. Anyway.
All right. Well, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, David.
There was a friend of mine on murder. And the judge's gavel fell. Jury found him guilty, gave him 60.